Welcome. You guys are at the seminar for Children, the Chattel of Modern Day Warfare. My name is Matt, and we're your seminar assistants helping you out. And today we're lucky to have Conrad, and he's the president founder of the nonprofit organization called Child Voice, which is based in New Hampshire. And they work mainly to service children that are affected by war. And right now, they've been in existence for 3 years, and so they're mainly focused in northern Uganda, working on community development, and I think right now they're especially focusing on females, right? That are being, like, female children that were affected by the war. So, yeah, it's their first time at Urbana, so if you guys can all just give him and his friends all a warm welcome.
Thank you so much. How many of the rest of you, this is your first time here at Urbana? Wow, a lot of first timers. Now I'm not alone. No, this has been, you know, we go to a lot of missions conferences, but I've never been to one like this. And just have an incredible opportunity to talk to young people about missions and what God's doing around the world is just an incredible thing for you to experience it and for us to be able to be here and be a part of it. So we're gonna spend an hour anyhow talking to you about some of the things that's going on around the world as relates to children who are involved either in armed conflict or affected by armed conflict. And then we're going to give you plenty of opportunity to ask us questions. And I realize this is a hot topic, that there's a lot of interest in kids affected by war, and we want to certainly field questions from you as well. You know, as we get started here, there's a word in the English language that I remember seeing probably for the first time in junior high school and had no idea what it meant. It was a very odd word. It was a word that, when you tried to break it apart in terms of its parts, it didn't make sense to me. But as I've gotten involved in this work, working with children affected by war, it's taken on new meaning. And the word is oxymoron, and it's a Greek word. Made up of two parts, oxy and moron. And it means in Greek, pointedly foolish. But in the English language, we talk about it being a figure of speech which produces an incongruous, seemingly self-contradictory effect, like a child soldier. That's certainly not two words you would put together or would choose to put together, because from our perspective, it doesn't make sense. Let me give you another one. Child mother. Again, something that we would not normally put those two words together, but we find child soldiers, we find child mothers, tons of them in these conflict zones in which we work. So when you think about that, it sort of brings to light the fact that there are things going on with children that shouldn't be going on with them in these areas. We have found, and researchers have found, that children tend to be the primary victims of armed conflict. They end up being, today, and probably for some time, they've been both its targets and its instruments. You know, when you read news accounts about the Middle East, and you read news accounts about young people, both boys and girls, who will strap bombs on themselves and walk into a cafe and blow themselves up along with everybody else around them. You know, you've now realized that that child is not only a victim, but it's also an instrument of war. And more we're seeing this happen for a whole variety of reasons. But one of the things that's very, very common in conflict zones around the world is that you see children, first of all, many of them being killed or disabled, maimed, because of the effects of war. We're working currently in northern Uganda, where There's been relative peace now for the last 2 years, but we still have incidents of kids playing who will dig up a landmine that will go off and take legs and arms, sometimes lives. And the impact of that war can have a long-lasting effect long after the war is over. As you might guess, many, many kids are made orphans as a result of war. Their parents either are involved in the conflict or they're victims of the conflict, and as a result, we see many, many children who are living life now without their parents, many of them raising their own brothers and sisters as child-headed households. We see in a lot of conflicts today, we see children abducted. And certainly in northern Uganda, that has certainly been the case. How many of you have seen any of the Invisible Children documentaries? Wow, this is great. Because you've got a good sense of what we're dealing with in northern Uganda. If you've seen the first one that came out in 2004, and then they've made several additional documentaries since that period of time. But you certainly have seen and experienced some of the fact that in that particular conflict, they've estimated now over 30,000 children have been abducted. We've seen the numbers as high as 65,000. Nobody knows for sure how many kids. There's certainly been a lot of kids who haven't come home. And nobody knows for sure what the numbers are, but they're astronomical, to say the least. Oftentimes, whether it's in northern Uganda or any of these conflict zones, one of the things that happens is that children's education is interrupted. In the case of northern Uganda, people were forced into IDP camps. That's an acronym for internally displaced persons camps, basically refugee camps. And most of those kids, when they moved into those camps with their families, if they had them, dropped out of school. Kids, either by choice or by the fact that their schools are no longer in existence, end up getting their education disrupted. The traumatization is something that we can't even begin to get a handle on in terms of, they estimate in northern Uganda that over 70% of kids have seen someone killed in front of their eyes. You know, I can't fathom what that must be like for myself, much less for a young child. But it's certainly been the case, and you know, there are people who say, well, kids are resilient, they'll get over it. But I don't know that you ever get over that. But we see incredible amounts of trauma, both in children and in adults, as a result of conflict. The concept of child soldiers is something that is very, very common, not only in Uganda, but all across the globe. We'll talk more about that in a bit. The whole concept of displacement is something that is, we heard last night from Ruth as she talked about people on the move. And, you know, as I sat and listened to her last night, I thought about what we've experienced in northern Uganda, where people were forced out of their communities and their homes because of the violence, forced to live move into IDP camps where they lived on top of each other, just horrible places to live, and many of them lived there, you know, 20-some years. But the whole concept of no longer being able to live where you want to live is something that Ruth talked about, and it's certainly something that is very, very common in conflict zones around the world. You know, and then lastly, the impact on girls and women is something that goes far beyond anything that we would want to imagine or even think about. They are oftentimes the most vulnerable and suffer the worst in a conflict. And, you know, there's just something about men, when you put a weapon in their hands, they feel like they have power that they didn't have before, and they abuse it horribly. And oftentimes, girls and women are the sad victims of that. And we'll talk some more about that after a bit as well. But when you think about children, and internationally, when we define a child, we talk about someone who's from 0 to 18 years of age. When you talk about children of that, in that age range. We view them, first of all, as being innocent victims. Very, very few children choose to pick up a gun, choose to be involved in the violence that comes with war by themselves. We do know that in some cases they are being exploited and subtly recruited into some of the ranks of like Al-Qaeda and some of those terrorist cells like that. Some children, because out of rage, what's happened to their own families, will choose to pick up a gun or go to fight who they view as the perpetrators of the people that killed their own families. But in a normal circumstance, these are not kids who would do this. And we need to understand that kids are vulnerable. They're able to be exploited in those sorts of ways. And we need to view them as innocent victims. We find that children are oftentimes the least equipped to be able to deal with the issues that come along with conflict. And that's why, and we're going to talk more about this in just a bit, that's why oftentimes children are recruited as child soldiers, because they can be manipulated, they can be brainwashed, and forced to do things that adults wouldn't do. And lastly, children are the least responsible for conflict. I can't even think of a situation where children on their own led a rebellion against a government or another people group. It's always somebody else who manipulates and exploits children for those efforts. But to put that all into perspective, you have to come back and you think about who are children. And children for all of us represent the hope and the future of our societies, our countries, our nations, our communities. And when you destroy them or take away all the things that make us who we are, you end up destroying a whole society, a whole culture, a whole nation. And it's the reason that all of us need to be concerned about this. I was at a conference recently, actually in Iowa, and one of the ministers, when I say a minister, it's not a religious minister, but a government minister from Pakistan was there, a very, very high-ranking official, and stopped by to talk to me. And as he looked at, and we talked about who we were, one of the things that he said after sitting there and thinking a minute, he says, "We need what you guys are doing." And he was speaking about what we do as Child Voice. And he says, "Because what I've come to understand is that if we don't intervene in the lives of children now," and he's talking about his own country of Pakistan, he says, "those will become the future terrorists of tomorrow." And so when we think about why we should be interested in this, I mean, just from a global defense point of view, a global security point of view, it's important for us to get involved in the lives of kids now. We've certainly seen it in our own country as it relates to gang interventions and that sort of thing, is that you need to get involved when the kids are young and when they're still willing to talk and to listen and put in positions where they can turn their lives around. Because if you don't, they will begin a life of crime and devastation that can go well into adulthood. I'm going to show you a short video clip that I think will help you to sort of understand the global impact of war and armed conflict on children.
Yeah.
So I think you can get a sense that this thing is big and it's global and it's unbelievably devastating to the lives of little children who are forced into that sort of a situation. It's very, very hard to imagine as they grow up what life is going to be like for them with that sort of a background. I think the good news is that there's change coming and that there's a large amount of international attention being given to this now, largely because of something that happened in 1996 when the UN commissioned a study by Graca Machel, who is now Nelson Mandela's wife. The UN asked her to do a study on the impact of armed conflict on children. 2 years later, when this study was published, it was presented to the UN Security Council, and because of her notoriety and the professionalism that she brought to this research, it launched a lot of work on the part of the UN to try and, first of all, criminalize some of these acts against children and to categorize them into basically six categories of what are literally called war crimes. And there are a couple people who actually are on trial right now at the Hague for crimes against children. And that's all been because of the effort to try and make, any type of war produces crimes against humanity. The crimes against children are put at a higher level. And then in 2002, there was the optional protocol to the Conventions on the Rights of the Child that brought in some of this work as well as others. And the UN's worked very, very hard to get this ratified. And now there are 121 member states around the world who've ratified these rights for children. And, you know, interestingly enough, guess who the last two countries were to sign on board? Who would you think? Anyone? U.S. was one. Nope. The U.S. and the U.K. were literally the last two to ratify, to sign on. And this is because we've had for a long time in both of these countries, we have made it the military available to 17-year-olds. And if any of you, as you remember going through high school, and if any of you pursued either ROTC or whatever, you realize that there would be a way, if your parents would sign off, that you could actually join the military at 17. The US and the UK didn't want to lose that ability to amplify their manpower that way, and so they were very, very reluctant to sign on. But finally, through the efforts of the international community, they too have signed. But you know, the bigger challenge is you can have it written down, you can have it on paper, but if you can't enforce it, it doesn't really matter much. And so now the big challenge on the part of the UN and all of these agencies, including ours, that are working for this, is that we have to try and bring an end to the impunity for violations of these crimes. And there are literally hundreds of rebel groups around the world, and in some cases, countries' military that are operating without impunity, and nobody seems to care. And I think for those of us who do care about the rights of children, we need to be a part of trying to bring an end to that and trying to enforce the rules that are now on the books, the laws that are now on the books. But let's talk about what these six categories of war crimes against children are. First of all, it's some of what I mentioned earlier, it's the killing and maiming of children. That goes without saying that that ought to be considered a war crime, and it is. And so that was number one on the list. Secondly was the recruitment and use of children as soldiers. And like I said, this was the hard one to get through with countries like the US and the UK and others who didn't want to lose the right to be able to take older adolescents into the military. But I think a lot of us view the fact that even at 18, and we know from our own personal experience here in the US, young people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and other places suffer high degrees of post-traumatic stress disorder, partly because of their age. They're young, they're not ready for that sort of a graphic experience, a violent experience. The third one is attacks against schools and hospitals. And obviously these are critical in the life of a child. And so it is now considered a war crime if these institutions are being targeted by rebel or military groups because of the impact that they have on children. Number four, denial of humanitarian access for children. I don't know how many of you were following what was going on in Myanmar recently when that war violently came to an end. But one of the things that was going on was that the government was blocking access for humanitarian aid to come in. And that too is now considered a war crime because obviously people like in northern Uganda that were living in IDP camps were totally dependent on humanitarian aid coming in from the outside. And even under the best of conditions, 1,000 people were dying a week in these camps. But what we found was that, you know, that if you block off the food supplies, you know, those numbers would skyrocket because people were just so marginal in terms of their health and whatever. So they've now, you know, they're really trying to ramp up the fact that if you're denying humanitarian aid for whatever reason, that that's also considered a war crime. Abduction of children for whatever means. As we found out that it's not always, most of these kids are being abducted to be child soldiers. Some of the girls are being abducted for sex slavery and other reasons. So they've not identified other than to say just the abduction of children in and of itself is considered a war crime. And then lastly, as we talked about, the impact on girls and women is huge in these conflict zones. I would suggest, you know, I don't have any research to back it up, but just allegorical stories that I've heard on the ground in northern Uganda, but a lot of the rape that was going on was not being done by the rebels, it was done by the Ugandan military. And the very people who were supposed to be in the camps protecting women and children and other vulnerable people were in fact the perpetrators of this sort of stuff. And so no matter where it's happening at, if you're taking advantage and you're exploiting a conflict situation to rape and do other sort of sexual abuse for women and children, it's now considered a war crime. So I think we're hopeful that we're sort of taking step by step, getting to the place where, you know, we now have these classed as war crimes against children. We now have the International Criminal Court and other agencies now in place to help prosecute. What we don't have, and this is a real gap, what we don't have is the police force to bring these people to justice. And that's why Joseph Kony in northern Uganda is still in operation. He's actually in Congo or Central African Republic, depending on the day of the week or the stories that you're reading. But the fact that there is nobody who's got the capacity to bring him to justice means that the things that have been going on for 25 years today continue to go on. And so that remains a gap. And the International Criminal Court says it's their duty to prosecute this stuff, but it's not their duty to bring these people to justice. So countries need to do it, you know, multinational forces need to do it, but somebody needs to be the police force to bring these situations to justice. We're going to talk now more about the Uganda situation. I'm going to show you a short clip And for those of you that have seen some of the Invisible Children things, you may recognize this. It's one of their latest pieces. But I'm going to use it as a backdrop to a conversation that we're going to have after that with somebody who lived through that as both a victim and a child soldier during that period of time. So let's go ahead and let's just watch this short piece of video.
Forced the Acholi people of the North to become laborers and soldiers. After independence, the Northerners rebelled, and since that day, the North and South have fought each other for control of Uganda. A rebel leader from the South named Yoweri Museveni came to power in 1986. The Northerners rebelled, and a boy named Joseph Kony joined a group of rebel fighters that became known as the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA. He rose to leadership proclaiming spiritual powers, and he promised success to those who fought with him. Kony never came close to overthrowing Museveni, who is still the president of Uganda today. Over the years, Kony lost the support of his people, and in frustration, he brutally attacked them and began to abduct children to fight for his rebellion. In the last two decades, Kony has kidnapped over 30,000 children for his army. In 1996, Museveni forced the Acholi into displacement camps. Though the camps were originally meant to protect people, the conditions are so terrible, 1,000 die every week as they wait for emergency relief. We didn't understand how one rebel fighter, Joseph Kony, could terrorize millions.
He said that Kony is around here, you yourself here, you will run away. After now, I fear him because he's somebody using spirit. His eyes has become red in color. Yes, he walk on in water. He will do anything he like.
You know, everything is so illogical about it. They don't have territorial claims. They don't have political claims. It's just a cultic group around this figure of Joseph Kony. Joseph Kony is like the Messiah. He's like Jesus Christ. And the next hour, they're just killing innocent people for nothing, for no reason.
This rebel leader, Joseph Kony, why chop off somebody's mouth? Of what meaning is it? Of what political interest is it?
I believe that there are people in this world who live for evil. And for me, Joseph Kony is a very clear example, because he has made the life of hundreds of thousands of millions of people absolutely miserable. What a waste of life to live for that.
Father Carlos had almost died trying to meet Kony, but he told us about an Acholi woman who had succeeded, Betty Bagombe.
I thought, well, if people are dying, this is a calling. I think I should go. Chances of coming back alive may not be very good. I put it at 50-50.
So it was just you?
It was just me. From LRA, my God. It was very scary.
But there's young kids.
Yeah, oh yeah, 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 yeah. In fact, the children who guided me all the time were maybe 11, 10, 11. They poured their oil on me. They grabbed me by their neck sometimes. All kinds of weird things, very scary. First of all, I was just amazed at his own security. You know, the people who stand around him, he swerves this way, they swerve with him. And so he talks, his eyes are all red. So it really sends down fear. Kony considers himself a god. Even me as a person was skeptical about, is this somebody who is ready to relinquish that control, power and influence he has? Is this possible? I personally signed letters, 25,000. If you come out, I'll receive you, I'll resettle you. And LRA started defecting in large number. That was a huge turning point. Then LRA reacted by doing this. They started mutilating, cutting off, because people were defecting in large number, pleaded with him. The magnitude of killing we're going to do, it's going to shock the whole world. 3 months later, the Atiak massacre took place, where over 300 people were massacred, children. When I went there, it was traumatizing. That's not even the word.
Each time Betty has come close to a peace deal between the LRA and the Ugandan government, Kony has backed out, allowing this war to continue for 23 years.
Charles, I know how hard that is for you to watch that video. Let me see if I can bring that one down. Okay. Because it really brings to life for you, I'm sure, what you lived with in for 6 years. Let's go back. You're now 20 years old, just the same age as many, many of the kids that are in this room. When you were 10 years old, tell me about that day when you were abducted.
Okay. First, I would like to say thank you guys, to come over. For me, the hard time I started getting when I was 10 years. It was Friday, the last day for weekend to school. I'm in school, going back home. And we met a rebel in the road. And they make us sit down. We don't know where we're going. They take 2 hours and throw the kind of really young, like 4 and 5 years, and they sent back home. And me with my friend Barry, we get tech. We don't know where we're going. We tie up. After 2 days, my friend tried to escape. Rebel get him and bring back to me. Exactly what you was in the video, I did it by myself, my first time, and my first day to do that kind of thing. And I killed my friend by beating with a stick. And as I talk, I can't forget about it.
Charles, I know. Can't even imagine how hard that must have been. But I want to even take you even closer to the day that it happened. I've met your mom. I've met your brothers. I know that you had a mother and a father. You had 3 brothers at the time you were abducted. What was it like for you when you went into the bush that night? Tell me what was going through your mind as you thought about your family.
What had been on my mind? I never thought that. I've been thinking like I'm not going to get back again to see my family. And the thing that been going in my mind that because every day, every time we move around, they don't joke around. You try to do something, you're going to get really hurt. And I've been thought that I'm going to die very soon. And the next day, also, when I killed my friend, I've been thought that the next day is going to be me. And a lot of things have been going in my mind that I'm not going to be like as a person talk like right now.
So you're, even that day, you're expecting that you're not going to live through this.
Exactly, yes.
And, you know, it's just hard to believe at 10 years of age, you know, when you should have been playing soccer, you should have been playing with your friends, going to school, and now all of a sudden, all of that has changed. You don't know whether you're ever going to see your mom and dad again, and you're taken into the bush. And as you've told me before, those first days were awful days. Not only on the second day you had to kill your best friend, but they also put you through a process of inducting you into the LRA. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that they forced you to do in that first week.
Oh, that's the hard part. But it's not my favorite part to talk about it, but I would like to tell you guys, but it's very hard. Even you can feel it. Killing my friend kind of sometimes not really very hard for me on that time. Then after 3 days later when I killed my friend, they need me to promise that I'm not going to try to escape as my friend did. And they make me bend down, and they beat my back 15 times and 15 times on my stomach. If you cry, you cry because you're not going to be long alive. Out of 15, we left only 6 people left out of 16. Other people scream and yell and cry and died over there. And later, this one, the hard part. The government soldiers came over to attack the rebels group, and the rebels fight very hard, and they went, and they get 3 soldiers alive. And they bring one to me to kill again. That one, the hard thing I ever thought I'm going to do it, but I did it. That, they tie him, that soldiers, they tie him and bring it back to me and describe for me, Charles, this guy that been shooting us, that been killing us, the way we need you to kill him, just with the knife. They give me knife, and they told me that, they stand around me with a stake. They told me that to cut that person's neck, it put alongside, they put alongside. Which I did that one, the S-10. And as I talk, as a person, every day, every time, if I tell my story to people, just I see all that kind of thing in my face. And it's very hard to deal on this.
So it's not something you can forget?
Never and ever. It's going to be right there on my mind. And also, if I start getting, like, I'll be fine. Like, I feel I'm going to forget my story, my past. If I go to get a shower and I can see my wound and my body, just bring my mind back again.
Why do you think the Allah Raid does this? First of all, why did they abduct children? Why children? Why not adults?
Because children didn't know anything. They can do anything they told them. And the first time they find you at home, the first thing they're going to do, if they find you with your mommy and your dad together, they're going to pick you up from them. And they told you to choose one of your parents to kill. So that's going to be on your mind forever. If you kill your own parent and they take you away, that you're not going to move it on your mind. You're going to be over there and they keep pushing you, killing other people. And you feel like if they say that, oh, if you get back, they're going to kill you like the way you kill other people. You're not going to come back.
But it seems crazy to think about. I mean, I remember when I was 10 years old, I wasn't very strong. I don't know if I could have even shot a gun at 10. Why would they take kids so young, 8, 9, 10 years of age? I mean, did they really expect that you could become soldiers killing at that young age?
That, Zach, I don't know why he take young people, but they say if you know, when you have a gun, you move around, you can see a taller person far before taller person saw you before. So if you saw him, you're going to shoot him before he see you before. So that the part I heard from them.
So because you're smaller, you can hide better in the bush and they don't see you.
Exactly, yes.
But you didn't have any, I mean, they give you a gun. Can you even carry and shoot a gun at that age?
Well, for the first time, before they give me a gun, they make me train first. And when I trained, and they give me a gun, and dear, the training is not easy, because you're not going to eat, you're going to drink porridge. Porridge one day, and getting porridge also is not something easy.
Let me just stop you just so that I can help people understand what you're talking about. You're saying that when they took you to this training camp to start to train you, you were being fed once a day. You got a bowl of porridge one time a day, and that was it.
That is exactly, yes.
Okay. So in some respects, you were getting weaker and weaker as a result of where they had you.
Every day, you get weak.
What was it like at that training camp? What was it that they were trying to do with you there?
They train you the way you can roll, how to attack other people, and how to shoot a gun, a different kind of gun, and how to set a landmine in the ground, how to take it if it didn't blow up. That the part you train. But set a landmine in the ground is easy to setting down, but taking up the hard part, because a lot of people lose their life on that, because if you did a mistake, you're going to lose your head, or you can lose everything on you. So that's the hard part.
So they're training you to use guns, they're training you in military warfare, they're training you how to set and defuse landmines. Those are all parts of what they were doing. What about the other part of it, though? I mean, Kony claims to be a man inhabited by spirits, and I think you told me that when they took you from your home in northern Uganda, that you walked all the way to South Sudan, was where their training camp was?
Yes.
How long did it take you to go from Gulu District to South Sudan?
4 days. But that 4 days, like 4 years, because very hard, you carry heavy stuff on your back, you don't have shoes on your feet, you don't have clothes, you walk in the dirt like that, and don't try to ask for getting water to drink. Don't try to ask, I want to rest. If you try to ask, like, I want to rest, your rest is going to be forever. They're going to just kill you right there, which a lot of people lose their life because of that.
How many kids were moving with you in that group when you first went?
A lot of them. I think maybe like 3,000 something.
Wow.
And a lot of people die on the road too. Some water they want to take them, and crocodile eat when you see it right there. You can watch crocodile eating someone, but you can't take care about anything on it.
So you had people, you had kids that were dying all around you as you were going?
A lot, every day. You see, you watch them, and you feel like they're joking, but they're not joking. They're really gone completely.
When you got to this training camp, tell me what was going through your mind now. Did you really believe now that you were going to live, or did you still worry that any day now you could lose your life?
Well, during the training, I feel like if I get a gun, maybe I'm going to get feel a little better, because being a person don't have a gun, it's very hard. And all the time, I have to wait for people to get you food, because if you have a gun, at least if you go to mission and fight, at least you're going to get something to eat over there and get a little better. I've been feeling if I get a gun, I'm going to be okay.
When you laid down at night to sleep, did you think about home?
No. I didn't think about home, because they told me that no one at home for me. And I've been thinking like, oh, I need to fight and see how it's go. Because for the first time to be over there, I've been putting myself just to save myself first.
Met Joseph Kony pretty early on when you were in the bush. We saw in the video what people were saying about him, that, you know, he moves, other people move with him, his eyes are red. People believe that he's inhabited by seven spirits. What was your impression of Joseph Kony? How did you feel about him as a young boy?
Joseph Kony, as a person, I've been around him for a lot and a long time, too, with him. And he is a very happy person, first. And he laugh and make fun of people a lot. And the thing which I feel like he also pray, but the way he pray, different kind of prayer, which for me, I can't believe, because you're going to pray when shoes not there, sword's not there, and you're going to pray when you have a gun. The age of 15 to 9, just all the people always he pray with. And I've been among them. And for me also, I've been escorted with him, for him. In the morning, I have to get up and sweep the compound and take the chair and put it on a tree, and we're going to sit over there. And call me my boy. And I said, thank you, sir, like that all the time. But at night, you're not going to get sleep. If you get sleep, the commander is going to be patrolling and find you sleep. You're going to get beaten on your stomach and your back. All the time.
So what you're describing, and you've told me this before, is that you actually got to the place where you were a bodyguard of his, where you were actually living in the camp where he was, and as you said, you were serving him, you were taking care of his compound, you were having to stand watch at night over him. But it sounds like you saw a different side to him, a side that was almost human. I mean, people have described him as a devil, as a manifestation of Satan. But yet you're describing somebody different than that.
The only thing I got from him, sometimes the thing is going to say, if you don't believe it, sometimes it's going to be real. Sometimes it's not going to be real. It's very hard to talk about him, because sometimes it's going to say, you have to clean your gun, you have to prepare, the war's coming over next month. On this day, if you don't prepare, the war is going to be there. With you're going to be sad, but you have to prepare. And at the same time, that example, one of his top commander, Tila Gon, before T. Benson, Tila Gon's passed us in the gate, supposed to give her pistol, his pistol to us before go to meet Khan, and he passed with the pistol inside, and he just left and got in the house. And later on, Uchi the guns get back, and the next day, Uchi the guns get tied up and get killed by him. But we don't know how he know that. And also, kill director did like that, and also get killed. And Uchi Binsen also tried to change his mind to come back to government probe at home and get killed like that. So it's very hard to believe him. And that kind of thing you watch in a video like doing that. They do have a kind of group with they stay right there. They do that kind of thing all the time.
So, well, at some level, he seemed like a normal guy. At another level, you realize that he had a lot of power and that he was controlling the lives, the virtual lives of people around him. And he was choosing whether they would live or die. When, you know, and I want to ask a couple questions about this spiritualist side of him. You know, we saw in the video that they do these rituals, you know, where the kids are dressed in white and they have these, you know, where they're throwing the beads on the ground and that sort of stuff. Tell me what he was, you know, and like I said, he claims to be a man of God. He claims to be a prophet. He claims to be inhabited by spirits. Did you see that side of him, the spirit side of him, and what was that like?
Describe Khan's not something easy. A little bit hard how to describe him, but all the time he stay around people. He look happy, but if say something, don't try to joke on it, because the other people, you're going to find yourself, you're going to get killed like that. A lot of people get killed by him. But when he's talking in the public, where people are, you're going to see him like a very nice person. But if you get in a meeting with I commander, the order is going to come out. You're not going to like that. Or you like or you don't like, you're going to have to believe that. And for me, what I saw from him is not a person who's believer or like something like that. One thing I saw and I never forgot about it, and talk young people, the age of 9 to 15, and take us to a place where we're going to get prayer, and cut a sheep. And he told us that we're going to go to prayer, and you're going to step on the blood and step on an egg, and you go over there without a shirt, without a shoes. You have your gun and a purse and a magazine, like that, and get over there and put oil on you right here and over here and over here, and say that if you get back, you have to know for sure we're going to get you, and go and pray like that. And if you go back home, don't turn your back, look like that. If you look back, you're not going to belong to us. So you move like that for 4 miles without looking your back, and step on the blood, step on the X too, like that.
So let me see if I understand. You're saying that he would have this ceremony where he would kill a sheep, and he would require you to come and to step on the blood, break an egg, step on the egg, and he would put the shea butter oil on you. And was that a protection then when you went into battle, that you wouldn't get shot if you went through all of this?
He said that all those people was didn't look back, those his people is going to win the government, because he want to be government of Uganda. And it's not going to take long. And for him, didn't care. He's going to win the government with only 10 people if they trust what he say. Other people are going to die, or they're going to try to escape and join the government, and later they're going to get them, because he put oil on you. You have to know for sure he's going to find you.
So he basically was anointing you and telling you that if you didn't turn your back, that you would become part of his inner group, you would be part of his government when he took over Uganda.
Yes.
We know that many, many girls were also abducted, some of them as young as you were. Tell me what life was like for the girls that went into the bush.
Wow, that it's really the hard part too, because very hard how to watch those young girls, the age of 11, 10, and mostly like 14, 15. You're not going to choose, I like this person, I like this person. They're going to pick you like a thing, and it's going to have sex with you every day until you have a baby. And it's very hard to watch those girls with their running, when they're running, because you have a baby on your back, and you have a gun, and you have a short span. Only one thing you can drop among all those three things. Don't try to drop a gun. Don't try to drop the short span. You can drop the baby, because the next day you're going to have another sex and have. If you drop the gun, you drop your life. You drop the saucepan, you drop your life. That's the hard part. And very hard how to watch young people. Like, at the same time, a girl is going to start, is going to get sad because the government threw the bomb on you. Didn't know all pregnant girl is there or young person just like a week right there. They throw bomb on you. They throw bullet on you. And it's very hard to watch young girl with a little baby get shot on the back and throw the baby away and keep running the next day have sex again. And it's very hard to watch young girl get shot and die. The baby gonna be alive on the back. No one's gonna take care about it and die later or 1 day or 2 days later. So it's very hard for girl about that part.
So these girls were being given as sex slaves to the wives to the commanders or to anybody? Was it only the commanders?
Only commander. If you have a rank, you're going to have a wife. And you're not going to choose if I want the girl or I want this one, I want this one. They just go and pick that one. Go and pick that one.
And these girls weren't only wives. They were, as it sounded like you were saying, they were also soldiers.
They do a gun. If you don't have the other girl who don't have time to have, they didn't get a chance to have a baby. You have to know for sure you're going to be like a man. Any war is going to be there. You're going to fight. And don't try to step back. Most of the boy, if the wars come over, don't try to step backward. The port is taking backward, taking the wrong way, because you're going to get killed over there too. You have to fight all the time.
Came a point after you'd been in the bush for about 6 years when you finally decided you'd had enough and you were going to escape. Tell us briefly what that was, how you came to the decision, first of all, that it was time to leave.
Well, for the first thing I came on my mind, I've been moving to where people live, but let me start from the beginning, it's okay. We've been in the park for 2 weeks. Those 2 weeks, like, I can't believe it. No food, no water. You're going to eat the dirt. No water, you're going to drink your own urine. And a lot of friends shoot their friend because of urine. Girl could jump over you, boy. I need your urine. And you feel girl going to shoot you down. Boys could jump like that, too. If you feel going to shoot you down. So we've been moving through our people.
Let me just stop you and see if I got this right. So you're saying you're deployed. You're out fighting a battle. And you're out for 2 weeks at a time. And so you're sent from Sudan back into Uganda to fight. And it must be the dry season, and there's no water, there's no food. And so you're actually eating dirt, you're drinking urine because there's nothing else.
Exactly.
Because you have no choice.
Yes. Wow. Or you like or you don't like it. So we've been moving through people live. And we get a place where, you know, find food and find water, but we don't know the government is there, they make them voice and start sorting us down over there, and other people survive, others don't, because just right there. And I'm going to. So, we've been moving. Other people just could make it, sort very hard and die right there. We take only guns. For us, we can move. We keep moving. For me also, I get shot, but I survive. I get shot both sides of my leg.
But you were shot pretty early on.
Very highly.
Yeah.
And on that time, just I keep moving, and we get a place, we stay, and we make group, other people go with sick people. For us, we have to go and attack the government base. our commander told us to get a gun and uniform and shoes. So we have to go and attack the government. We are on a mission. Our mission to go and do that. And we move it at night. And I crossed the road, which I know before the rebel took me away from my home. And I crossed the road, and I stand over there, right there, and I look around, and I see the tree, mango tree, because mango tree over there, like apple over here. And I...
Wait, stop. Say that again. It's like a what? A mango tree is like a what?
Mango tree like apple.
Like?
Mango apple tree over here.
Oh, like an apple tree. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So, so I get to see that tree again and looking around, I say, well, I think I know over here. And my first time to cross where I know before, if I'm going to die over here, it's going to be great because at least someone's going to take my body home and bury my body down in the ground better than other people die over there, or could I eat them, or the animal eat them. So I've been moving with my mind changed completely. And we get a place where we stand. We sit down to organize very well how we're going to attack the government in the morning. And I have two guns, my commander and my gun too. And I called one from my friend that's been over there for 3 years. And he came, and I give my commander gun to him. And I told I'm going to be back. And my commander asked me, Charles, where are you going? I said, I'm going to go and use the bathroom. I'm going to be back. And he said, don't be long. And I get a chance to run. And I run just forever, all night. And in the morning, I get in a farm. I find one man. And that man just get run a little bit. And I scream and stop and get back to me and take me back home. And when I got home, a lot of people start coming to welcome me back home. And I found my mommy and my little brother born me for me. I'm not there. I don't know him. And my brother have to introduce me to him. That's this on your brothers. I say, that's great. And I lose my dad. And I ask, oh, where's my dad? And my mom told me that your dad, we're in a camp. And your dad tried to go to the village and get some cassava to feed your brother in the camp. So the government found him over there and get killed because they've been thought that he's a bad guy. I say, wow, nothing can do about it. And also, I didn't keep people in my village for long because I know for sure when I've been running, I didn't have any gunshot in the morning. I know for sure that will change their mind to get me back. So I told people, we have to leave and go in the grass. We leave like for 45 minutes. The rebel get home and they burn 57 house, burn down anything we move because they're really upset. They didn't find me and they just throw everything around. And they keep getting back and forth, try maybe they can get me. And the government soldiers have been keeping me for 1.5 months and they send me to counseling center. And I stay in counseling center for 1.5 months.
All right, stop. Back. We'll come back. We'll get to that in a second. You covered a lot in that short period, and I just want to make sure that we all understood it. So you're saying you were on this mission, and you were now in an area that was very close to your home village. You were starting to recognize farms and roads and things, and you thought that if there was going to be a time for you to leave, it was now.
Yes.
And you also said that you'd gotten to the place after being 6 years in the bush with these guys. This is sort of an important point because you're saying, I'm going to get killed here sooner or later. I'd rather die here where someone will see me and recognize my body than to die in the bush where they'll leave my bones for the animals to pick. So you sort of use that as a motivation to say, I'm going to run now, and if I get killed, so be it. But I'm close to home. Someone will recognize me because they'll leave me here. It's hard to believe that as a 16-year-old boy, that's the process that your mind's going through as you're making this decision to escape. The other thing that I think is maybe a little hard for us to understand is why this big rebel group would come after you. I think you had said that you were an attaché to the commander, and so you had a lot of stuff of the commander's. Is that right?
Yes. Oh, so I apologize for that. The thing why the rebels have been following me for, first, they're gunned. Second, the backpack I carry, my commander backpack. I'm not supposed to carry that one. But my commander trusts me because all the time we be together. And on that backpack, have a CD recorder with voice for Joseph Kony leader on it. And that we're supposed to give in to Ike Kamana, who is leading any mission terrible in Uganda. We have to give to him. But we didn't get a chance to meet him yet. And I did escape with that one. And they want to get that one back. And I ran with it, and I give it to government.
So you had some pretty really sensitive intelligence that was in this backpack.
Yes.
And this commander's life was on the line now, because he was not supposed to have let anybody but himself be carrying this. And so he was wanting to get this back badly.
Yes, and later on, other police escaped. Later, they say that guy got dropped from the major to second lieutenant.
So he got demoted because of the fact that he lost the intelligence.
Yes, and got beaten a lot too.
Right. Okay, so now you come home, and while you were grateful for this welcome ceremony, you also recognized that they weren't far behind you, and so you warned your village that they're coming. People got into the bush and hid, but you said 57 houses were burned?
Yes.
And so it just devastated your home village as a result of something that you were a part of. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, you talked about the fact that when you came back, you went through this rehabilitation center called Gusco for a period of time. You were with the military because they were debriefing you, trying to get intelligence from you. But once you got through all of that and you went back home, tell me what it was like to be a former child soldier, a former rebel, now moving around Gulu District. Tell me what that was like for you.
Be as a person is very hard getting back home, because the way other people are going to look at you is not the same they used before. And for me, because the rebel followed me all the way back home and people lose their stuff, the other police, they don't know how to forgive. They give me a really hard time. Although I try to push myself to be friendly with other people, I want to be like a normal person in the village. But it's very hard to make a friend again. And other people use, I know for sure over here you guys don't have a witch doctor. And over there we do have that. And other people want to use that. Ways I can be able to lose myself, because they're really upset because they lose their stuff. With they didn't work so much for them, but one family so have badly to kill me that they use, like, call me, they talk to my mommy that we need your son to come and have dinner with us. I say, okay, I'm gonna get there. And my mom said, Charles, you go there, have fun. I said, sure. When I get there, that woman gave me great food. And yet over there in Africa, where I grow up, if someone gives you nice food, you have to know that those people love you and they like you a lot. And they give me chicken and rice and soda. I say, wow, those people like me a lot, really. And they say, Charles, we welcome you a lot. We heard that you died a long time ago. And just, I can't imagine. You're welcome back home. I said, thank you. And she gave me food to eat. And I said, okay, put it in the table and open the soda. And I started drinking soda. And I saw the kids play around, and I light the kid. And I get over there. I want to say hi to them. And I lie down. And they play in my stomach and my chest and my back. And their own son is a high school student. Only 1 year left to go to college like you guys. And he eat that food, and they lose their own son because poison on the food. For me, I didn't know that. And it's been really sad to have that kind of thing people feel about me like that.
Well, why would they have wanted to poison you?
Because they lose all everything they have at home. And
so they blamed you for the attack on the village, and they lost all their home, all their possessions.
That is exactly the reason.
And so beneath this front that they were showing where they were welcoming you, their intent was actually to kill you.
Exactly. And the only way I survived, my auntie heard what was going on and take me from the village to the town. And I stayed in the town for a couple of years, and my aunt passed away, and I started hanging around Anna Branda for a little bit, and I met one of my friends, and his family allows me to stay over there for a couple of months, and I start stay over there and start, you know, moving myself very hard as a person to work very hard with rich people and get money and rent my own house. When I get opportunity to raise a place where I start rent my own house, and I get my mom in town and get my little brother also in town. And my second brother is 17. He's still in the village.
But do you think today, even though it's been a number of years now that you've been back, could you go back to Adak and live, your home village?
No, I'm not.
So there's still people there who are angry with you?
I'm not willing. Even my mom, that way I take her from the village to the town. Mm. People in the village give her hard time all the time.
So it doesn't end when you come home?
Not really. See, for me, I've been over here in 2007, and I get back home. And people keep pointing me. Charles, they've been in a rebel for 6 years. Mm. And that kind of pointing never end, because that's going to be like you. But the thing that came on my mind that you point me like this, even you can try, look around your friend and point someone like this. And those three fingers are pointing you back, yourself. And your thumb is pointing God know what you're talking about. It's very hard. And those people didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to take an opportunity to let you ask some questions of Charles, of me, about some of the work that we're doing, some of Charles's experience. We have a couple mics that are going to be coming up the aisle, so if you've got a question, just raise your hand so that you can get a mic, and then you can ask a question. We're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
My question is, I'm over here, sorry. Okay. What made you decide to come here and speak about your experiences?
Great question. The thing, mostly, he's the one who brought me over here. You know, he's the one who brought me over here to tell people my story and to get people know exactly what's going on around the world, because a lot of people over here, even you don't know what's going on around the world so much. But now you got opportunity to hear, although you've been here in the news or on a website, like whatever. But now you heard from the personality. And I'm here to tell people my story. A lot other people in Uganda or whatever they are in around the world, which they don't have voice to raise or to tell what they go through, and I'm here for it. I'm here in the USA, just not Charles. You're not watching just only Charles. You're watching other former Charles or in Africa or in Vietnam, in wherever they are, because I met Vivekan Ripoll.
Okay.
Hi, Charles. I think it feels utterly ridiculous that a single guy is doing all of this. And this is not actually a question for you. I think it's more a question for the speaker. I don't know your name.
Conrad.
Because I came in late. But what is the United States or other first world country, quote unquote, what are we doing about, what are they doing about this? I mean, it's just one person and is being able to terrorize a whole nation. What's going on, and how can we get involved with activism, not necessarily going to minister to those children, but trying to get some people to wake up here and do something?
Thanks so much for that question, because it clearly is something in a way for you to be involved. And for those of you that have engaged with Invisible Children and been part of their efforts, you've made a huge difference already. Prior to 2004, the world didn't know about what was going on in northern Uganda, and those three guys from Southern California really revolutionized, I think, the media in terms of getting this story out. So already you've played a huge part in bringing international attention to this thing. It's a very complicated, it's a very politicized situation. You've got to address the issue with the Uganda government at the same time you're trying to address the issue with Joseph Kony. if you want to get into some interesting dialogue with Charles at some point, talk to him about how they operated as soldiers in the bush, masters at guerrilla warfare. And as you might remember, about this time a year ago, there was a multinational force that went after Kony in DRC, Congo. And we actually have two girls in our program now that were there at the time of that attack. And they bombed five empty villages because Kony has incredible contacts and intelligence throughout northern Uganda, through, we think, into the government, certainly within the diaspora. If you look at his peace team, you see lawyers from the US, from the UK. They're getting money from all over the world. And I think that it's not as easy as it sounds to say that we ought to be able to take in US Special Forces and go in and get this guy. Now, there is some truth to that. I think, because I've been involved with the military, I've got a lot of confidence that if we send in Special Forces, that they could probably bring him to justice. But then you get into the political situation about why should the US, why should the UK and other first world nations be interested in Uganda and be interested in DRC? And if you don't know it, you need to understand that since the Rwanda genocide, where 1 million people died, actually 800,000 people died 10 years ago, there have been 4 million people, going on 5 million people, that have died in Congo since that conflict. And nobody's talking about that. And the truth of the matter is that there is not enough there for the US and other first world nations to invest themselves in these sort of conflicts. And the prevailing view, in my estimation, is that governments in the first world are saying, let Africa take care of Africa. And it's unfortunate. But you kids, you young people, have already made a difference. And you need to keep lobbying for US support to try and bring this guy to justice. He's not the only one, however. There are many, many other rebel leaders in Congo and Sudan who are also involved in this sort of atrocity. And we need to be working on all of it. But there is legislation that has now passed both the House, there's a House version and a Senate version, a resolution to bring an end to this conflict. It now has to go back and they need to reconcile the two bills. We hope that'll happen the first part of the year. But you still have an issue where even if you have legislation, you have to have a will to execute and implement it. And I'm not convinced that there's enough there for the US to do that yet. But I'll tell you what, your congressmen, your senators are listening to you guys when you speak, you go to their offices and you speak about this thing. They love seeing impassioned young people who are involved in social causes like this.
Great, two things. I was working in DR Congo with LRA-affected people earlier this year and also in Uganda, and I heard a lot of Ugandans saying that the Ugandan army doesn't actually have motivation to stop Kony, because they are receiving so much money from the US and the UK, and they just kind of pretend that they're going after them and maybe capture a few people and say, you know, we're doing our job, but they're also like staying in nice hotels and they don't want that money to stop. The second thing is from a lot of Congolese people, I heard stories of abducted children being put into helicopters and taken and sold as slaves in northern Sudan. I talked to Invisible Children about it, and they said I needed to gather more evidence before they would look into it. So I was curious if you knew anything about that in terms of trading the child slaves for arms, that Sudan is supplying arms to the LRA.
Wow, you bring a lot of stuff to the table there. And it's confirmation for a lot of the things that we hear as well. We have, because we're located, our project is located in the bush halfway between Gulu Town and the Sudan border. We've got access to intelligence both from the UPDF, from the South Sudanese Liberation Army. And so we're able to, as well as some of the UN stuff that we get, so we're able to triangulate a lot of that information and confirm some things that if you just listen to the Ugandan army, you'd hear one thing, but when you put it up against what you hear from the SPLA, you hear something else. But a lot of what you're saying is absolutely true. I personally do not feel that there is a will on the part of the government of Uganda to put an end to this thing. We had a military commander, and we have soldiers embedded in our project, We had a military commander a year ago tell me that he was there, and our project site was the site of a massacre in 2004, and he was there as part of a military installation there at the time. He told me, he says, I was one of those that ran away when the rebels came in. And I looked at him, I said, why would you admit that? And he says, you need to understand. He says, I'm from the South. He says, I am not going to shed my blood for these people in the North. And I think what you're hearing is the fact that there are 65 different people groups in Uganda. There is not a nationalist sort of feeling about this conflict. There is a lot of tribalism. There's a lot of disdain for people in the North from the people in the South. And even though they're forced, because they're members of the military, to go serve there, they do not have the will to put their lives on the line for the people in the North. And that's just a sad commentary, but it's absolutely true. I think also the government was getting a lot of money coming into northern Uganda through NGOs and other billions of dollars of aid were coming in. And I personally believe that if Invisible Children and others hadn't started bringing attention to this thing, that this would still be going on, it would still be flying under the radar, we'd still be seeing billions of dollars of humanitarian relief coming into northern Uganda, because the government was benefiting from that. And again, they were willing to sacrifice this people group to get that sort of aid. We've heard the stories too about Darfur and others, that Kony is now linked up with some of the rebel commanders in the north. We've known for a long time that money's been flowing out of Khartoum to the LRA, if you talk to Charles and others, they'll tell you that they had much better weaponry, much better communication systems than the Ugandan government had. And that money was coming out of northern Sudan, it was coming out of the Middle East. And I personally have a belief, and again, understand this is my personal belief, that we need to be concerned about sub-Saharan Africa. Because when you start linking the pieces together and you start looking on a map of all of the countries that surround Sudan, you look at Chad, you look at Central African Republic, you look at DRC Congo, you look at Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, and you look at all the insurrection that's going on there. All of that is being fed out of the Middle East. It's all part of a international jihad movement to try and destabilize Africa. And I think those of us that are believers need to be concerned and need to be pouring support in to support the church and others in sub-Saharan Africa, because they're the only ones who are going to be able to stave off this radical Islamic sort of influence that's coming in from the Middle East and the North.
We might have time for only one or two more questions. Can we hear from some men in here? I know you're thinking. All right, one in the back.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for telling your story. I know that God loves you and he's giving you his strength. Just was wondering what is available in terms of the therapy. And I know that UNICEF and some of these other organizations are there trying to provide different means of counsel. And I don't know, I know less about the social support in terms of the community that you return to, but in terms of immediate intervention for escapees, who is doing what in terms of your mental and spiritual rehabilitation?
Need to get that all right. Like, you try to get who's taking care about to convince me to be like a normal person. Like, oh,
who's providing? You're pretty normal.
What I'm referring to is basically just your everything that we've been hearing is stories of trauma, and that's very much what war creates on all different levels. So in terms of, reorienting, re-identifying yourself as no longer the soldier that killed his friend, but you're still here, You know, God's given you a voice, and you're only 20. So, I mean, it seems as though you've got a lot ahead of you. And I'm just curious about that therapeutic intervention, if that makes sense.
I'm going to let Charles answer that in just a second, but we're going to queue up a short video that'll show you what Child Voice is doing, and there's others like us that are doing this sort of, that are interested in the question that you have, which has to do with psychosocial and spiritual counseling for traumatized kids. There you go.
In 2006, northern Uganda was a virtual wasteland. After 20 years of war, 90% of the population was living in squalid conditions in displacement camps. Over 30,000 children had been abducted by the rebel forces and used as child soldiers and sex slaves. Thousands had been killed or maimed by marauding bands of rebels. Families and communities were ripped apart, living in fear of the next rebel attack. Thousands of children, night commuters, flocked into the cities every night to sleep on the streets. Can you hear? Lakoti, a small village just south of the Sudan border, was the site of one of the most horrific single-day massacres. In the late afternoon of May 19, 2004, the rebels swept in, trapping people in their huts, setting fire to the thatched roofs, and killing or maiming anything that moved. Children abducted, thousands displaced, voices silenced.
Cry, Jesus, help me to see the morning.
In June of 2006, Child Voice began to reach out to this traumatized community with the aim to restore the voices of children silenced by war. Over the last 3 years, there has been a remarkable transformation of both lives and community in Lakoti. Strafed by bullets and rocket fire during the massacre, the old Lakoti primary school was literally falling apart. Child Voice began to dream about renovating it for use as a pilot program for formerly abducted girls and child mothers and their children. In October of 2007, it reopened as the Lakoti Center and home to 30 child mothers and their children. Child Voice built and opened the new Lakoti Primary School in February of 2008. Strengthened by a supplemental feeding program, the village children now have the hope of an education and a future. Lakoti and the surrounding area had not had any healthcare services for over 20 years. So in June of 2007, Child Voice opened the Punena Health Center, just down the road from the Lakoti Center. In the past 2 years, over 27,000 patients have been seen and treated by the Child Voice medical team. Once eerily silent, the walls of the Lakoti Center now reverberate with the laughter and chatter of adolescent girls and their children. They're learning to read and write, as well as gaining skills in a trade that will provide them with the resources to be an asset to their families and communities. Confident in their safety, these girls are healing from the horror of their past with a Christ-centered understanding of forgiveness and reconciliation. Child Voice is a Christian organization seeking to restore the voices of children silenced by war.
We are just one organization, and a very small one at that, that cares about the kids of northern Uganda. And we are running a pilot program for formerly abducted girls. We'd love to be serving boys as well, but we're only 3 years old as an organization, and with limited resources, we've only been able to serve girls. You know, we've got 25 girls that have finished our program now and gone home. We have another 17 that are in the program right now. Another 15 are coming in January. And we have hundreds and thousands of girls that are asking to come. And we don't have enough resources to be able to do it at the moment. But ours is one type of intervention. It's a residential intervention. There's others that are doing community support and community counseling and that sort of thing. So there's a number of efforts going on. We're trying to find what's the most effective way to be able to provide ongoing psychosocial and spiritual support to these kids and communities that have been traumatized by this war. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's one way that we're doing it. I know that we're running out of time here, and I wish we could spend some more time with you. But thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it.